Right. Good afternoon, everyone. Let me see. Is there a pointer here? Sometimes if I want to highlight something over there, I will try to see if I can hit it. Anyway, again, as Jeff said, the topic this afternoon is designing biochars for in situ remediation of metal contaminated mine spoil. So I work for the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, and one of the things that we work on is the Superfund sites. And sometimes these are contaminated with a variety of things, but I've been focusing on metal contaminated soils, and that's what the talk is going to be about today. We're going to talk about these things, what's the problem, how can biochar help solve the problem, designing biochars to address the problem, and ensuring that these biochars are doing what we intend them to do at the various sites, and then come up with some ways of monitoring site conditions after we've made some amendments in tracking these over time, and finally some comments about the outlook for the future. So let's talk about the problem. In the U.S., there's approximately 500,000 abandoned mine sites across the country. Not all of these are big. In fact, a lot of them are very small, but they do pose a threat to human health and the environment. If you think on the worldwide stage, there's quite a few more, and there's it's a serious problem. And our hypothesis is, or our mandate is, that contaminated soils and sediments require remediation to, again, protect human health and the environment. Another area of application is degraded soils. Now, there's many thousands of hectares of degraded soils, too, and we believe that biochar may have a role in bringing those back into food production and good functioning. But one of the things we would state at the outset is that new and advanced materials are needed that can be engineered to address these specific problems. If you're familiar with the way Superfund sites are remediated, quite often it's a dig and haul operation. You dig up the contamination, you bury it someplace else, and look for things to put in the hole that you make. And so we're trying to come up with some more creative ways actually that are cost saving and can be done in situ. And from the literature, and I think from many of the science reports that you've generated, we know that biochar has beneficial and tunable properties, and I'll talk about that a little bit more. You can reduce contaminant exposure by limiting exposure pathways and by immobilizing contaminants. You can help restore soil quality and health, and I mentioned this on degraded soils, and enable in situ remediation. This is where it's done in place, where we come in and amend the site and promote revegetation, revitalization, and reuse of these sites. And as Claudia mentioned, it's a carbon negative material, meaning it can actually be used to extract carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, not as an absorbent, but through the plant growth and photosynthesis. So let me give you an example of a couple of sites where we're working. This is called the Formosa mine, and I'll be showing some data from this today. But it's a copper-zinc mine in southern Oregon that was in operation for a number of decades, and then the owners, the people running it, disappeared and left quite a mess for the public to clean up. And it's on the Superfund list of priority sites, and it's a Superfund site mainly from acid mine drainage. But you can see also that the tailings have been piled up. They're quite acidic. The pH is around 2.5 to 2.6. It's coarse fragments, and virtually nothing grows on this site. The second site we're working is in what's called the Tri-State Mining District, which is in Missouri, Kansas, and Oklahoma. It was the place where half the lead for the bullets in World War I came from. And in that extraction, they did low-tech smelting at the surface and spread the spoils, the leftover materials, on the soil surface, and you see piles of it here. And then the way it's remediated, they come in and you basically remove the, what they call it, chat, or this spoil material, and actually take it back underground and bury it and put it under water. And that's a great way of getting rid of the lead. Unfortunately, there's other things in that spoil material that leach out, things like zinc and cadmium, and you're left with a subsurface soil at the surface. So it makes it a little rough, and there's a lot of issues that go on with revitalizing a place like this. So in this image, you can see the Formosa mine from space, and our objective is through amendments and revitalization, we would like the site to look like this image without using Photoshop. And so it's the kind of thing where we want to be amending these soils and bringing in organic matter and other materials, including biochar, and getting native plants established and growing. And then, but how do you take a site that looks like this and turn it into a site that looks like this, which is a site that's close by the Formosa mine? We believe it takes strategic intervention that can include biochar and other amendments. So one of the things that is obvious as soil scientists and researchers is that when you come to a site like this, there are limitations. And they really fall into three categories. And of course, there's the chemical limitations. There's metal toxicity that will prevent plants from growing. It's the metals that can be leaching and blowing or moving around that can cause exposure and threats to human health and the environment. And there's also sulfur-bearing minerals that are creating low pH conditions. They're low organic matter and low in nutrients and high in these metals. So it's difficult. So there's chemical limitations. There's physical limitations. Quite often these materials are compacted. They have a lot of coarse fragments, very little pore structure, poor water infiltration or water holding properties. And then sometimes material is very deep. Sometimes it's very shallow. Sometimes you're close to water and other times you're not. So there's physical limitations. And finally, there's biological limitations. There's low activity, whether plants, microbes, or other organisms. There's low diversity, or you have the wrong kinds of organisms. You know, there may be acidophiles versus the other kinds of organisms you'd find in a healthy soil. So these are all limitations and things that need to be overcome, and part of our strategy is to address all of these. And much of the literature that is gathering says there are ways to use biochar to attack most of these. I can't change the depth of water table, but I can change water holding characteristics. I can adjust pH and, you know, some of the properties of biochar that would be advantageous to use and capitalize on. So let me just kind of reiterate some of the points about using biochar at these sites. You know, biochar has been shown to be effective at absorbing inorganics and actually even organics as well. So you're not only limited to metal contaminated sites, but that's the focus of my work. It can be used to raise or lower the pH, and you know that that comes from how you make the material. Is it high temperature, low temperature? Is it got a lot of ash content to it? Grasses versus, say, softwoods. You can also use it as a source of nutrient retention through cation exchange capacity, or by blending biochars, you can actually add nutrients like phosphorus, calcium, and what have you. There's a number of papers that show that biochar can be used to help infiltration and water holding characteristics, and these can be capitalized on in these kinds of sites. And then the other thing that I think is an area for real opportunity is using biochar as a tool in rejuvenating the soil, to bring back the soil to life by adding labile carbon and also providing a refugia for microbes. And again, we've talked a lot of times about the utility of high temperature biochars having a long residence time in soil, so adding carbon that actually becomes a storehouse in the soil. This is a table from Shrestha and Lal from 2006, and it basically put together some ideas about using biochar to address these limitations. You know, we can see in the physical arena, we can address things with soil structure, erosion, and moisture. In the nutritional areas, we can use it to add nutrients or hold on to nutrients. And then adjusting the pH can give us some leg up on adjusting the soil pH to the more favorable, reducing metals or actually tying up metals. So we're building on the ideas that are in the literature and trying to apply it in places that have serious issues. And Jeff Novak and company have spent a fair amount of time putting together some ideas on what they call the designer biochar concept. The whole idea that you can take various feedstocks and blend them, and then through your pyrolysis conditions and various other things that you do to this material, is design or engineer the biochar to have the properties you want to do the things you want to do. You know, so be very selective about it. And one of the things, bullet three, is there's things that we can measure in their static properties that give us insight to their performance in the field, and that's what I'd like to spend a little bit of time talking about. And it's really important, I think, once you know, not all biochars are created equal, that before we go out and do a big deployment, we actually need to really test and ensure that these materials are going to work and do what we hope they will do or expect them to do. We need to demonstrate that. So we're all probably familiar with this figure from Johannes Lehm in 2007. It basically shows that as you raise the temperature, you can change the properties of biochar. And in particular, he looks at cation exchange capacity, pH, and surface area. And so the benefits seem to increase as the temperature goes up in a lot of cases. But depending on if you want a lower pH material to, say, bring a pH down, you may want to go lower temperature. And this is some work from a number of you in the room. But again, applying feedstocks, pyrolysis conditions to address various impacts, whether water storage, nutrients, lime. And one of the things that's important is the form of the biochar. Is it a fine dust? Is it pellets? Is it chunks? These are things that need to be considered, you know, to have that good soil biochar contact, good soil water biochar contact. And there's also some downsides working with really fine powders. So one of the things that we've learned, I think initially I thought that biochar could, you know, solve all of our problems, and it can solve a lot, I think, but it's good to use other amendments that are perhaps better at doing things. For instance, having lime or biosolids, and here's a list of amendments that we can use in conjunction with biochar. And what's important, at least to us, we're trying to use waste materials from other waste streams. One of the objectives we've got is to try to take things or keep them from going into landfills, but use them in positive ways to amend and remediate contaminated sites. So we'll talk about these in a little bit. But we have some goals when it comes to remediating a site. And you know, the idea is that we want to immobilize metal contaminants through absorption, precipitation, and complexation. And the whole idea is to reduce their bioavailability to plants, animals, humans, and prevent their movement or transport. And you can see why that's important if you're doing something in situ. You know, that if there's a mine site that's really remote and you can go out and make some of these applications, well, then you've basically eliminated its sort of serious impact on water table, or the environment. And so again, it's kind of repeat, you want to reduce the hazards, reduce the exposure, and again, we want to restore soil function and ecosystem services. To, you know, there's a lot of these sites, like I said, 500,000 in the U.S. Imagine those either back for you know, vegetated with wildlife and actually recreation, or even back in useful production. Again, we like the idea of using sustainable plant cover through native vegetation. Okay, so how do we do this? So we've been trying to put together a way of screening biochars that, you know, once we have materials made, how do we know it's going to be useful at a particular site or mine site? So we have a three-step process that we're looking at right now, and step one is to, once we have a biochar made and we know something about its properties, we challenge it with an extract from the, it's called a simulated precipitation leaching protocol. It's an EPA protocol 1312. Basically, it's a mildly acidic solution. You extract the soil and you take and filter that solution and then challenge the biochars with it and ask the question, which biochars remove the metals of concern? That's part one. Part two, then, is to look at which of those biochars actually hang on to those metals once they're absorbed onto it. And Claudia showed some nice slides of absorption and retention. That's exactly the concept. We'd like to see metals go on irreversibly and stay on. You know, there are a variety of extracting solutions you can really compete, but we have some ideas in that area as well. And finally, you want to take your best biochars and start going to germination studies, greenhouse studies, and really test its properties and its behavior and its performance. I want to tell you a little bit about a study that we did, and it's just way too much information here, but there's 38 biochars that we used to look at the Formosa mine site, to challenge the SPLP solution from that mine. And you can see that they're made from a variety of feedstocks, a variety of temperatures, so we got quite a range of characteristics here. Then we take the SPLP solution, we add a biochar to it, and you see which ones remove metals. So here's a figure that shows several things. So on the left here is the amount of zinc that was in solution from that SPLP extract. So it's 8,400 parts per million zinc. The rest of them show what's in solution after being in contact with the 38 biochars. In this particular case, you can see a temperature effect. That's a Douglas fir biochar, that as the temperature goes up, the withdrawal of the metal increases. But you can also see some of these biochars effectively remove 100% of the zinc. Now that's quite a bit of zinc in solution. Here's the equivalent kind of figure for copper. Again, there's some that do a really good job at removing it, and others do less, but by and large, they're removing the copper. So what we do then is we take, in this particular case, there's five metals of concern, zinc, manganese, copper, cadmium, and nickel, and we look at the withdrawal of those materials, or those elements from the SPLP solution. So in this case here, this material, I just call it ARS wood, I can tell you more about that, it removed 100% of all five of those metals. Number two was a miscanthus biochar made at 700 degrees, and it removed 499, if you add up the percentages of the metals. And then I like to put this in, we included granulated activated charcoal, and it came in number 21, meaning there was 20 biochars that were better than activated charcoal, which is sort of the industry standard for cleaning up solutions or water. The second thing is then to determine the binding characteristics. There's a variety of ways to do that, but a simple way to do that is to look at, you then take the biochar with the metals on it and you challenge that. In this case, we did that with a 0.01 molar calcium chloride solution. So the black bars are what was removed from the SPLP solution. The yellow bars are what remains on the biochar after the calcium chloride challenge. In this particular case, you can see, and this is a beef manure biochar at 700 degrees C, that effectively it removed 100% of these three metals. This was copper, cadmium, and zinc. And it retained 100% of the metals it removed. So this is a very good biochar for remediating the site that this solution came from, which is that tri-state mining district. Then finally, we then start, before we go to the field, we start doing quite a few things in the greenhouse, and one thing that we do is we do a germination study. Just because you'd think a biochar works, now if I go and apply it to a soil and it prevents seed germination, well, we might have a problem. So we developed a test to assay seed germination. On the far left, you can see 25 seeds of blue wild rye, Elymas glaucus, which is from around where the Formosa mine is. And then I've got some close-ups here. We look at various streams. So you look at the seeds in the Formosa soil. There's no germination. You look at seeds in lime. You can see a little bit of germination going on. So lime is good. Then you start looking at with 1% biochar, 2.5%, 5%. You see not only increased germination, but you see a lot healthier plants. So part of our germination test, then we look at shoot weights and chemistry of the soils after the amendment. So it becomes a way of screening. We can start looking at the amounts of biochar, the kinds of fertilizer to use. And then we go to the greenhouse, and this is a variety of studies that we've done. The first one panel looked at, this is work done with ARS Lab in Corvallis, and they came in and added, you can see the variety of percents of biochar, 1, 4, 9, and 15%. 15% is probably unrealistic, but at the same time, you can look at the plant growth, and that's biochar alone, no other material. Then we go to the greenhouse, and in the panel C, you can see what lime and fertilizer, you can see some seedlings there. You can see if you don't add any lime at all, but you still add fertilizer and biochar, you don't get any germination, so the pH is pretty low. And then finally, if you add all three, you get a fairly decent response. This figure is a study we just finished, again on the Formosa soil, looking at soil lime and using biosolids. Again, like I said, we like to use waste materials, and biosolids are a really good source of nutrients. But if you can look at, this is again Elm scolascus, and if you look at the soil and lime, we get a fairly decent response. With soil alone, nothing. You soil and biosolids, you get a little bit of growth. But if you look at lime and biosolids, you get substantial growth, and but with biochar, you get even more. So each of these represents one seed, and they had 29 tillers in one case. All right, I need to get moving here. How many minutes? Two. Okay. One of the things that we like to do is to, what kind of targets are we going to set? So we go and get a soil that's proximal to our site, we characterize it, and we say, this is what we want our site to look like eventually. And we do the things we can to move it that direction. And what we like about target soils, they have the properties that approximate the final soil conditions. And then it gives us an idea of what's achievable, especially given the climate niche that we're sitting in. And then we start ranking the priorities there. If you look at this table, you can see the target soil properties here. You can see the actual properties of the site. And then we use that information in a radar plot to ratio. The green is the native or the target soil. The orange is what the site is actually like right now. And with time, we'd like to see the series like this, where it's becoming more and more filling so that we are tending towards our target values. And we've come up with a thing I call remediation index, where you basically take the space of the metrics covered by the treated site over the target site, and you can get these increases with time. Wow, he's getting close to me. I want to show you something we just did recently at this site. So we came in, we think we know how to remediate this soil, and we've used a geoprobe to drill out 16-inch diameter by 24-inch diameter soil hole, and then we've brought in our amendments, and it's quite a bit of biochar, so it's 2.5% biochar, 1% lime, and 0.25% biosolids. We put it in a cement mixer, we mix it, we put it back in the hole, and if you look at the field, then we have, these are going to be locations where we plant trees. We're going to come in between the rows in the winter, amend that, and that'll be for grasses and herbs and various herbaceous materials. So let me wrap up. Are you going to grab me or? Okay, I have 3 minutes. Oh, okay, there won't be any questions. No, that's true. So again, it makes a lot, it's just logical, and we're going to be putting this together in a sort of a tech transfer document. The idea is to identify the limitations, figure out where you're going to need, is pH the biggest limitation, then could biochar take care of it, or should we use lime, and kind of crunch through it all, and you finally get down to the point where you're going and you're doing things in the field, and you can back it all up through greenhouse laboratory studies, and then you put them in place and you monitor it. So the last thing to say is I think that biochar has an incredibly bright future in remediation and in cleaning up contaminated sites. The talks you hear today will provide a lot more information about other potential bright spots. But anyway, I'd like to talk to you about what we're doing and what your interests are, and if you have some ideas that you think might be helpful to us. So I think I'll quit there. Hey.
Last thing you guys did, 2.5% biosolids to remediate them.
Yes.
How much it cost to remediate the site, how does it compare to other sites?
Yeah. Okay. This is a question I get quite often, and for this particular case, you're not going to like the answer. The answer is it's the biochar is being given to us for free. And I can have as much as I want. So the thing that's interesting is we work with a collaborator who uses who makes the biochar, but he is using it. He heats wood debris from a sawmill, drives off the syngases, and drives that into a boiler that he heats to make hot water to heat 5 acres of greenhouses. The biochar is a waste product to him, but it turns out it's one of the very best biochars I've run. It's made at about 1,400 degrees C. It's very clean. It's very very potent. But it's a real question, and we run into this. So in this particular case, at this site, they estimate the cleanup cost is $20 million. Okay, my guess is, and I haven't penciled it out, we could remediate the site, meaning revegetate the site, for probably half to a quarter of that. So if you kind of, if you look at the societal cost, it's minuscule compared to some of the other things that we do. And so we're trying to look for ways to implement this, either in small ways, large ways, at these kinds of sites.